As usual, at the end of a long conference day, our energy is waning just a bit, but I think the issues that we want to talk about here tonight are really enough to sort of re-energize us. And we have a very distinguished panel that I'll be introducing you to shortly. Most of the day has been spent on hearing from at least all of these panelists, except for Brother Felder Freeman, who unfortunately had car trouble and will be joining us tonight. He should have been here yesterday and spoke, but we have made room for him here. So his misfortune, it is our fortune because he can be with us tonight. And so we now have five panelists, and so you will be able to hear from all of them. Our first speaker for the evening is Dr. Mark Mitchell, and he's a homeboy who we are letting Connecticut have for a while so he cleans that up and maybe he'll come back home. But Dr. Mitchell is head of a very powerful group, the Coalition for Environmental Justice. And it's very interesting, his background had been one of public health administrator turned activist, and now is combining all of those skills to really fight for environmental justice. And we'd like for him to come to the podium and share his expertise with us. Dr. Mark Mitchell.
Thank you. And good evening. Let's try it again. good evening. I'm certainly enjoying my return to St. Louis and the welcome of the audience here, even if the St. Louis police don't give the same kind of welcome to those coming from out of town. I want to talk a little bit about bioengineering and particularly about environmental justice. Environmental justice is the opposite of environmental racism. And environmental racism refers to the fact that low-income communities, and particularly communities of color, bear a disproportionate amount of environmental hazards. And when we talk about environmental hazards, we're talking about all types of environmental hazards. In fact, the state of Connecticut looked at 10 different categories of environmental hazards, and in 9 of them, people of color are more exposed. And we're not only concerned about the environmental hazards, we're also concerned about the health consequences of those hazards. We're seeing more asthma in our communities. We're seeing more cancer in our communities. We're seeing more diabetes in our communities. We're also seeing low birth weight. And all of these things have been associated with environmental exposures. There's evidence that all of these things are associated with environmental exposures. So environmental justice is not only making sure that there's not an unfair burden, it's also making sure that there's a meaningful involvement in the discussions and the plans on how these things happen to get into our communities. I don't know how many of you were voting as to whether Monsanto should be in St. Louis. Did you? How many people voted? Did you discuss it with the regulators? Tell me what you when you were talking to the board of Monsanto. What kind of things did you ask for the community when they decided that they wanted to build and expand in St. Louis? Well, that's meaningful involvement, and I'm sure that somebody, I'm sure the people not in this room are involved, but I'm sure that somebody was involved with that. And I bet that the people didn't look like a lot of the people in St. Louis that were involved in what the land should look like, what kinds of jobs are going to be available, who's going to be getting those jobs, and even what's coming out of the smokestack. You know, what are these chemicals that are being produced? What are the people who live nearby being exposed to? Those are the things that we're concerned about. We're concerned about why in the last 20 years asthma has doubled. We're concerned about why in the last 20 years the asthma death rates have tripled. We're concerned about why African Americans between the ages of 15 and 25 are 6 times more likely to die of asthma than any other group. Well, is it genes? Are we predisposed to asthma? Well, Genes don't change unless you have genetic engineering. But the genes in people's families don't change. There's environmental exposures that are changing. And we need to find out about these environmental exposures. We need to make sure that people aren't being exposed. Now, what is this genetic engineering? What are they doing? Well, they're creating crops. And I'm sure many of you are aware that they're genetically engineered, and most of the crops, the crops that are most often used that are genetically engineered are the soybeans, corn, and potatoes. And some of the things that they're doing with those crops are increasing pesticide resistance, increasing herbicide resistance, the Roundup Ready crops, that is the crops that are resistant to Roundup, herbicide Roundup. And they're also making terminator genes, that you put in plants, you plant the seed, and the plants grow, but the seeds that they give off won't grow anymore, so that you need to go back and buy new seeds. Now, as a scientist, I'm also a physician, a public health physician, and as a scientist, there are certain things, as a physician, there are certain things that I worry about with genetic engineering. And one of those things is allergies. The increase in, we can expect that with the types of proteins that are being produced in these products, that there'll be allergies. And we don't understand much about allergies and what triggers allergies and which types of crops, which types of wheat have allergies, which types of soybeans can trigger allergies. The other thing is that we're concerned about is some antibiotic resistance. Well, why would they have antibiotics in plants? Well, it turns out that some of the microbes that they use to insert the genes into the plants also have antibiotics in them, and there's some people are concerned that the antibiotics that are in those microbes that are transferred to the soybeans can provide, as the soybeans are eaten by animals or they're eaten by humans, there can be a transfer of those genes and that people can become resistant to ampicillin and some of the other antibiotics that those microbes had. We're particularly concerned about the Roundup Ready types of products, because what this allows is that since soybeans are not they use Roundup to kill weeds in the fields. And since the soybeans are more resistant to these herbicides or weed killers, then they can put more herbicides in the fields. And so the people who are working in the farms are oftentimes low-income, Latino, African-American, from the Caribbean people who are working in the fields. And they can expose them to more of these pesticides, more of the herbicides, and it may be hard for you to believe, but they don't have the same kind of insurance plan as they do with Monsanto executives. So when they get sick from these exposures to pesticides and herbicides, they don't get the same kind of, first of all, they're not likely to be diagnosed. And secondly, they're not likely to be treated appropriately. We're also concerned about that since there's only one gene, the genetic variability in these plants, and since there's only one set of genes, there's no genetic variability. So these crops are going to be susceptible to other types of pesticides, other types of pests, and other types of fungi, and other types of predators. And it will encourage new pests, it will encourage that the pests change their genetic structure to attack these new types of crops. And as they do that, then the people that are going to be exposed to these new pests with these new variabilities are going to be the people who are in the fields. And again, those people tend to be people of color. We're also concerned about the effects on other species. You know, when you deal with biology, it's unpredictable. We know that that the genetic makeup of all types of animals and plants changes on a regular basis, and they change in response to changing environments. And so we expect that we're going to see unintended consequences from this, and those consequences are going to affect humans. And the consequences are much more likely to affect low-income communities and communities of color. And this is the kind of thing that we see, in environmental justice, that we're concerned about in environmental justice. We believe that companies like Monsanto, Solutia, should be required to label products that contain genetically modified substances, and to monitor those products at a minimum, if they're allowed at all. There should be a lot of testing before these things go into the market, because they're, again, biology is not predictable. We're treating this as if it is a science, whereas you can engineer a bridge and the bridge will stay there and it'll be exactly the same in 30 years as it is today. Biology doesn't work like that. Biology changes, and things and pests and other animals change in response to that biology. And we're very concerned, again, that that the people who are least likely to know about these risks and least likely to suffer these risks are going to be the people who hear about this last. So that's why we're concerned about genetic engineering and environmental justice, the health effects of the environment on low-income people and people of color. Thank you.
Dr. Mitchell, I know that when your parents sent you off to school to study genealogy, they never thought you'd be a grassroots organizer, did they? We appreciate your work in Connecticut, and knowing that you could be doing a lot of other things, it makes me appreciate you even more. We want to bring next a brother who's been definitely in the trenches as well, Carlos Morentes. And this brother is the founder and director of San Fronteras Organizer Project, and also the co-chair of the Farm Worker Network for Economic Environmental Justice. And primarily, he's been dealing with issues of migrant workers and other farm workers. And so let us give a warm welcome to Brother Morentes.
Buenas tardes. My organization is based in El Paso, Texas, because El Paso, Texas is one of the most important gathering places in recruitment sites for farm workers along the United States-Mexico border. For many years, our farm workers, the men, women, and children who produce the food that keeps us alive, have come from the South. Thanks to them, every day we enjoy rich food, vegetables, fruits, all kinds of farm products to help us keep going, to grow, and make life okay. But from the south of the border also arrive our meat packers, but sadly, the immigrants continue to fall victims of an economic model that is based in cheap food production by lowering cost of production. Every day, many lose their lives attempting to cross the border to be here. I cannot pass this opportunity to express our deep concern by the increase of deaths of immigrants. I'd like to recall a couple of recent tragedies to call your attention. Just last Wednesday, law enforcement officers found 17 bodies of immigrants inside and outside a trailer near Victoria, Texas. The deceased included 6 women and a 6-year-old boy, Jose Antonio Villaseñor. Later, another survivor died en route to the hospital. The dead immigrants were part of an estimated group of more than 70 undocumented who were being transported back inside a trailer truck. You know, when animals are transported, at least there are holes to breathe. Not in this case. On March 25th, 2003, as part of the harvesting, a sugar cane was set on fire in Raymondville, Texas. A group of 6 undocumented workers, which included a female, had been hiding in the field. 5 of them died of suffocation and severe burns. One saved his life by running out of the field as soon as the fire started. These are testimonies of an economic model under which human life, as a famous Mexican composer, José Alfredo Jiménez, once wrote, "La vida no vale nada." Life isn't worth anything. Immigration is the result of 2 factors created by this model. On one hand, migrants who are desperate because they are unable to survive in their homeland. And on the other hand, they are pulled by North American demand for the labor force. But migrant farm workers not only endanger their lives crossing this country, they also risk their lives in their workplaces. Because our economic model, some people call it neoliberalism, is a system under which the mandate for farmers and producers is to produce more, not to produce better. And in order to do that, they have to rely in the use of all types of dangerous chemicals and technology to exploit the land and the workers of the land. Historically, farm workers have been the most exploited and neglected labor force in the U.S. The public record is well known. Let me just mention a few critical issues. Migrant farm workers earn less than $7,000 a year. 6 out of 10 farm workers in U.S. don't have a roof, a place to live. Migrant farm workers don't have the right to organize like the rest of the American labor force. Since 1983, I have been connected to agriculture production in southern New Mexico and West Texas, where thousands of human beings, men, women, and children, work very hard every day, but sometimes the wages that they receive is not even enough to eat 3 times a day. The chili industry of southern New Mexico is worth $250 million annually. Yet the farm workers are the lowest paid in the Southwest. In Luna County, the chili pickers were making $25 per 12 hours work day in August of last year. Economic injustice is not the only problem faced by farm workers. On April 22nd of this year, a few weeks ago, I took a large group of workers to attend a hearing in the District Court of Las Cruces, New Mexico. They were part of 131 workers who filed a complaint against a farmer from Las Cruces. The complaint was for multiple violations to their labor rights. The violation ranged from not doing the proper social security deductions to false payroll records. But you know, the most important demand of the workers was that the farmers were forcing them to work in their needs all day, weeding the fields with their bare hands, even though the norm for this type of work is the use of long-handled hoes provided by the boss. And I can go and on talking about the problems of farm workers. Of course, health and the poisoning of farm workers in the fields is one of the most serious problems. And already the previous speaker mentioned very important facts about this problem. To us, the poisoning of farm workers in U.S. is the classic example of environmental racism. Why? Because 7 out of 10 farm workers in the United States are from Mexico, are Mexicanos. ¿Qué importa? Son Mexicanos. They are the same immigrants who had to cross the border to escape misery and economic justice in their own land. But it's not only human beings cross the border. Thanks to the neoliberal economic policies and free trade agreements, highly toxic, dangerous chemicals cross back and forth our border. Not only Mexican farm workers in U.S. are exposed to pesticides in American fields, agribusiness and chemical corporations have brought the poison to our rural communities in Mexico. We now see more agribusiness and food corporations taking advantage of free trade agreement and the failure of Mexican peasant economies and have moved to operate in Mexico and other countries globalizing exploitation. Farm workers in Mexico earn less than farm workers in this country, although maybe both will be working for the same company and producing the same thing for the same consumer. The serious situation of farm workers in the United States is tied to the situation of farm workers south of the border. Let me emphasize this because this is the key to understand what to do with the situation of farm workers in the United States. If a jornalero can pick chili in Delicia, Chihuahua, Mexico for a daily salary equivalent to $5, then the employer of New Mexico, USA, who might even be the same, will attempt to reduce the cost of labor to be competitive. The employer in New Mexico will be unable to pay $5 a day because that will be a violation of the federal minimum wage of $5.15 per hour. But he can make the New Mexico chili picker work more than usual by getting paid on a piece rate basis so much for each bucket of chili. In reality, the farm worker in the United States earn less and work more every time. The same element applies to the use of chemicals and dangerous technologies. We now see the same skin diseases suffered by the chili pickers of New Mexico in the chili pickers of Delicia, Chihuahua. In a system where you need to produce more and cheaper to be competitive, you are forced to use any tool available regardless of the impact on human life and or environment. I like to, because this conference was about bio, something I cannot pronounce that word. I'd like to mention something about, I'd like to end saying something about GMOs. To us, it's clear. GMOs are part of the modern technology used by corporations to accomplish total control of agriculture and the food system. We still don't really know the impact of GMOs on our lives, but we should be very concerned as producers, like the family farmers, as farm workers, as consumers, and as because we are in St. Louis, Missouri, as Christians, we also feel concerned, and as members of civil society, and we have to learn from the, and we should learn from the past. When synthetic chemicals were introduced in an intensive, massive commercialized way, we were told that by controlling pests and crop diseases with these chemicals, things will be better. Farmers will increase production, and the world will have enough food. But the result has been a disaster. We now have farmers who are landless people. Thousands of human beings, especially farm workers, have died or have become severely ill, a lot of them disabled. Our environment, especially in poor rural communities and especially in communities of color, is now severely contaminated. The damage done by agricultural chemicals are so severe that will take a lifetime to alleviate the damage. In fact, there are damages done to our environment by the use of agricultural chemicals that will never be cured. And who are the responsible for these damages? The same corporations like Monsanto trying to impose GMOs and other modern technologies. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Carlos, for letting us know about the despicable conditions in Texas. It sounded like that was some third world country, you know, but I guess we have to keep in mind that's Bush country as well, so anything can happen, but I guess my hope is that the information that you gave to us will strengthen our resolve to really challenge those policies, particularly the international policies and the so-called immigration policies that are both racist in this country. And it's interesting that the whole contradiction between immigration policies and the fact that immigrants, particularly from Mexico, are being lured to come here to work under those conditions, knowing that the average American worker would refuse to work in that. So on the other hand, we're saying keep the immigrants out, but on the other hand, allowing them to come in and work under such savage conditions. So we got a lot of work to do, y'all. We're gonna bring Brother Felder Freeman forward, and talking with Felder, we realized that we had a friend in common. I was able to meet Ben Burkhart some years ago, who headed up the cooperative down in Mississippi when I was traveling covering the Jesse Jackson campaign and the impact of Super Tuesday in the South. And I kind of got a chance to hang out with Ben and got an earful about the amazing land lost by black farmers that were just almost happening, acres being lost daily. And then there were all kinds of other issues that have been compounded since then, notwithstanding the whole genetically engineered piece of it. But we're gonna bring Felder Freeman forward, who is from the Federation of Southern Cooperatives from South Carolina, and bring us greetings from the South. Brother Freeman.
Thank you, Jamala. Good afternoon. I was raised in a pretty isolated little area in South Carolina. They call it Gullah Country. I was born and raised on John's Island, about 15 to 18 miles out of Charleston City proper. And I remember my city cousins used to like to tease us about living behind God's back. Well, in that time, you know, I was born in 1951, and when I grew up, environmental racism wasn't a term I heard. It wasn't even a concept as far as I knew. We were sort of like busy dealing with the all-around racism, so We hadn't focused on the specific type yet. And actually, my first introduction to the concept was fairly recent, and it came by meeting and talking with somebody who was at the time working on an environmental racism issue. A young man whose name I can't remember at the moment, but I remember that he had been working on the issue of pollution in the Gulf of Mississippi, and was from a community, or represented a community called Sugar Ditch. Well, in talking with him, that sort of like fleshed out my perception of what environmental racism could be. And I realized that in actuality, it had happened in South Carolina, it had happened in my community, and in some instances, had it happened to me. When I was in college for a while, I had a friend that was from the town of New Ellington, and in talking to him, he told me some things about the community he lived in that didn't really strike me as being that odd at the time. He worked part-time at the Savannah River nuclear plant out of Aiken-Barnwell area in South Carolina. And the little town he lived in was about like a 15-minute drive to work. And I learned from him that New Ellington was the successor town to the town of Ellington, which the United States government needed to build a nuclear plant in back in the early 50s. I don't know exactly when the land takeover was completed, but they moved this complete town that was like 75-80% black. They moved all of the residents off, took over the property, built the Savannah River plant there, and then moved the people further upriver, built them another town. Well, it's nice that they built them another town, but the racist part is that these people didn't get a choice, a vote, or voice in the matter of when and how they had to move. We pretty much accepted back then that the government could do what it wanted to, when it wanted to, but even then we knew that had this been a white community, it would not have happened so smoothly, so easily, and wouldn't have been buried in history so quickly. So that was my first realization of how it was. And I had already started working for the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, so their mission and operational area gave me the opportunity to encounter it on other occasions. In Charleston, the closest city to where I live, they have a fairly busy port. I think it may be the second busiest on the East Coast and maybe the fifth busiest in terms of volume every year in the country. They had a need to expand, at least this was promoted by the Ports Authority, that they needed to expand in order to compete with other ports that might siphon off business from them and then as a result push them into a lower economic strata. Guess where they chose to target as the expansion point? Right east of the Cooper, bordering the Wando River, was this little black community that had developed right after the Civil War. The people had purchased land that had been abandoned by the slave owners, plantation owners, and they had pretty much built a community there in the 125 years since. Well, this area was targeted as the place to acquire the land. And even before any decisions had been made relative to whether or not regulations would allow, permitting would allow, the terminals or the Ports Authority's representative had already begun buying land from the people that lived there. And they were able to succeed at it by basically showing them a plan that they had and telling them that if you sell the land now, you'll be able to get market value. You wait until the state condemns it, because South Carolina does have that authority with eminent domain. If they need it, they can condemn it, take it, and basically pay you what they feel like. So some of the older residents and some of the ones that are a little easily intimidated had already sold their properties by the time the Federation came in the picture. I was contacted by a young lady that was the director of a community organization that pretty much came together specifically to oppose this, and went down to about three or four different meetings where the issue was, you know, pretty much fleshed out with the public, representatives of the Ports Authority, our political leaders, and some of the City of Charleston representatives. Well, the upshot was that because the terminal not only threatened to take away the land of the black people that live there, predominantly, there are very, very few segregated neighborhoods left in the South except the gated communities now. But because it basically threatened more than them, this was an issue that you could mobilize a lot more than just the residents of that area around. The Wando Terminal actually is right close to some of the richest real estate in Charleston County, and as a result, some of the richest in the state. They're not that far from the Isle of Palm, which I just saw on one of the, what they call the Blue Water or Great Beach list that just came out. I saw it somewhere since I got to this town. And also the town of Mount Pleasant is their nearest town, just a couple of miles away, considered to be the best living area in the county. So the residents there thought that expansion of the port would not just displace these black residents, but would also degrade their quality of life. So we had an issue around which we could mobilize a broad spectrum of the people. And even today, this issue is not dead now, but it's been beaten back for a while. And if you can buy enough time, you usually get a chance to expose some of the weaknesses in the earlier proposals and get a chance to offer alternatives that make equally good or better sense. And that's where the hope lies right now in terms of our being able to do this successfully in the long run. It's already been demonstrated that what they want to do there is not necessary at that location. Another alternative site had already been identified where the economic needs of the community is much, much greater than where the Ports Authority proposed to put this. And that community has now begun lobbying to get a port expanded. They already have a port too that would be down in the Beaufort area. So with these kind of forces coming into play, this is one issue that we might be able to win. But those early land purchases, the way that they chose to just basically try to accomplish the fact before a decision was made, is one example of how environmental racism works. Had they been able to purchase enough of this land in time, then there wouldn't have been enough opposition even from the residents of Beaufort and the Isle of Palms to actually stop it, because then they would have the argument that they're too heavily invested now to turn this around. They'd already had an Army Corps of Engineers impact study that was approved, but usually in that area, the people don't give but so much credibility to anything the Army Corps of Engineers does, because it's sort of a good old boy system there, where the same people that direct that might have a brother on the Ports Authority, similar kind of thing, where the linkages are not seen publicly, but they're powerful enough to work whether people can see or not. Charleston also is in the process of building a new Cooper River Bridge that's already started, and unfortunately, this is one of the battles that we didn't really have a chance to win. When they built the first Cooper River Bridge, they displaced the black community and pretty much left the group in a little of a neck, a little area that was hard to access and only had one area out, and everything else was basically to the river. Now, that community survived, I believe, from 1938 until the present, survived, thrived, and in some cases prospered, because black people are sort of unique. If you leave us there long enough, we'll learn how to manage it, and if you give us an opportunity or two, we'll learn how to make it work well. Well, now, at this point, they need the same land that they were relegated to some 50, 60 years ago to build a new bridge. So they're being pushed off now from this land, and they really don't have a prayer, because with the way the environmental impact study was done, there's no other place they can put this bridge that would be economically feasible. The bridge is about like a $350 million plus project, so you know everybody that got a chance to make a dollar off it is salivating at their opportunities to go on and collect that dollar. So it'd be like next to impossible to generate any political support around it, no matter what the community thought. And that's pretty much considered to be a done deal. Now, those issues are sort of current. But you know, the more you talk about anything, the more you realize that there are some other things that have happened that you didn't index at the time, but had pretty much the same kind of effect. In 1965, the interstate system was extended through the city of Charleston, and we got I-26 running basically from Charleston all the way through Greenville, going northwest. Well, when they needed the room to build the highway right through the middle of a city, guess who had to pay? Guess who had to give up their homes, their land, and the place that they developed? Black people. In this case, a community was cut, not in half, but split down the middle in such a way that all of the ties that have been developed over the years between families and businesses and institutions was disrupted completely. And what made this even more significant and make me suspect it as being a part of environmental racism is that 1965 was also the year that integration came to Charleston County. Basically, it was the first time that black students could attend previously all-white schools. Now, we didn't have any white kids coming to black schools, but you know, it's sort of like one of those things where we were given what they call freedom of choice. We were free to choose to go to a white school if we wanted to, and white kids were free to harass us for the privilege of going to their school. Well, one of the things that happened with the I-26 corridor is this. The oldest, most historic black school in Charleston is Burke, that still exists, Burke High School. And during that year, with integration, freedom of choice would have allowed another school in the white area to basically become nearly half black, or have such a high percentage of black students, until the racial divide would matter a lot. Once they strung the corridor down, then Burke High School remained and is till today about 90 to 95% white. And enough people were taken from the opposite side of this corridor to integrate Rivers High School, to where they got up to about a 20% black population, enough to satisfy any federal regulations, but not enough to threaten the balance of power. So on reflection, you know, this is like, what, 40 years later? Now I can see how this may have had a part in it, environmental racism. At that time, I really didn't know enough about it to really be able to make a decision. And usually that is what those kinds of actions are predicated on, the lack of knowledge or information in the community that you intend to victimize. Now, I was talking to Jamala earlier, and she was talking about a visit she made to the Low Country to go and visit her roots, I guess. And the name of Dafuski and Hilton Head Island came up. And I sat there for a while and I thought, now this is really a classic case of environmental racism. Dafuski Island is isolated much more than John's Island ever was because it was so far from the mainland that if you didn't go by boat, you didn't leave the island. Plain and simple, even today, that's the way it is. Hilton Head is a sea island that has basically the same kind of demographics in terms of topography anyway, but it was connected to mainland by a bridge. Between 1960 and 1975, Hilton Head Island was developed almost completely. Dafuski is still very rural, still very inaccessible, still very poor. And what happened is that because Hilton Head was available and accessible, those who had the dollars to develop it basically moved black landowners off the land. Well, you know, they purchased it, but they, you know, at their own advantage. So that is another way that environmental racism plays out. And on the island I live on, might be a little trivial example, but you know when you start scratching, you start itching a lot. I remember about 8 or 10 years ago, an issue that was sort of resounding was the building of a bike path. Now, the way John's Island is situated is that there's a road that comes down the middle of the island, and there's a creek on the western side. And since it was a sea island and basically was settled during a time when the river was transportation, the river was economics, the river, life basically evolved around the river. Almost all of the houses at one time was on that western side of the road. Most of the black property owners owned property on that side of the road. In the years since, starting in 1970, two sea islands that were basically barrier islands were developed for tourists and upscale development. Those people needed a bicycle path because they're the ones that have bicycle clubs and they might ride 25, 30 people in one group going up and down the road every day. There are black people on the island that ride bicycles all of the time. They don't have a bicycle club and they tend to be few and it's all a widespread movement around. And I know they didn't ask for a bike path. In order to get the bike path, the land had to be condemned by the state, purchased, and the bike path put in. Believe it, the western side is where they took the land for the bike path. Well, it was only about 8 to 10 feet, but if you take 8 or 10 feet from everybody for about 3 miles, then you've taken quite a bit of land. Now, all of these people weren't black, but for every white person that owned property on that side, there are probably a dozen or more black people that own property on that side. And this is another example that, and that's the reason this sticks in my mind, is because even the residents of the island were up in arms. We don't need a bike path. We don't want a bike path. They want that bike path for Kiwa and Seabrook. Well, they got the bike path. They took the land from my community. And even though they paid for it, we didn't have a choice as to whether or not we kept the land. And that's what I call environmental racism.
Thank you very much. I was caught by surprise, you know, because I'm still under the influence of this drumming and music. And so that's what I wish we could be doing instead. And that's very important because that really is being an organism. You know, we are forced to become machines. I mean, this whole framework, this whole model that we're living under, it forces us to regard each other as machines, as instruments, as means of exploitation, as means of making money, competition, we talked about that. You know, it has very, very deep roots. And Well, let me just start from the beginning, because there are certain things, loose ends that I want to tie up from what has arisen from previous speakers. One of them is the GM crops, how it's going to affect black farm workers or the poor, because what we're talking about now is not just environmental racism, it's actually it's a kind of a corporate genocide which is actually imposed on anybody that doesn't fit into the model, that doesn't actually, is surplus to requirement according to this kind of globalized model, and that includes everybody who's poor or unfit in some sense. And you see, this kind of a bad science model that we have is works so closely, works so well with the corporations, is because they share the same mindset. And this mindset worships competition, competitiveness. That's how, you know, that's how the world is organized, we're told. This is how it is. Now we had a little discussion in the workshop as to, well, this is the model and we've got to work with it. I mean, do we have to? I think we have to really sit back and say, for heaven's sakes, let's you know, go into our heart and say, what is the good life? What is the good life that we want to recover? You know, I, for myself, I'd like to be able to spend the rest of the evening dancing, learning how to dance again with the drums and everything. That's how I feel tonight, and that's what I should be able to do. And I once, when I went to this, what is it called? It was an oxymoron, you know, because it was supposed to be an ethics conference in in Emory College, I'm afraid, you know. I think it was a Coca-Cola University or something. It was about ethics, and I could tell you not, it was about bioethics, okay? And that was really an oxymoron, and I was a little upset, and we had a little workshop, and so I asked all these bright young people, you know, sort of preparing themselves for a very competitive world and things like that, very high-powered. So I said to them, well, look, why don't you just sit back, use your imagination, you know, never mind what the reality is. Just use your imagination and say, what is the good life for you? And you know, without exception, they all said they want to get out of this rat race of making money. They want to have a simple life. They want to among friends, among people that they respect and that respect them. And they want to have a community. And here we are, you know, miserable as hell because we have to, you know, fit ourselves into this neoliberal, globalized nightmare that Monsanto, Syngenta, and the rest have created for us. And so, anyway, I said I was going to tie up loose ends and I digressed again. All right. There are some practical issues about GM crops. When you are a farm worker, you are with the GM crops, the first line of defense. And research by UK government scientists, at the time when they were still allowed to publicize their results and be a bit honest and leak the results to people like us so we can make a fuss about it, they already pointed out that there are dangers from pollen, from plant debris, you know, that could be allergenic, and also that they also contain DNA, transgenic DNA, that could be transferred horizontally to bacteria living in the mouth and respiratory tract of people. So the farm workers and the food processors also are the first line of defense for this kind of hazards. The other thing is, you know, ISIS, my institution, was one of the first to call for GM-free food aid. And the reason why is because when in populations that are malnourished and their immune system are compromised, they are especially susceptible to the kind of hazards that genetic engineered crops, genetically engineered foods could pose in the form of antibiotic resistance, genes being passed on to bacteria in the environment and in the gut of people, making, if these happen to be dangerous bacteria, it could make infections untreatable. Also in the sense of the dangers of horizontal gene transfer and recombination, because this transgenic DNA is made from viruses and bacteria that cause diseases, and they can actually recombine or exchange genetic material with viruses and bacteria that are in the environment to create new ones. And if your immune system is compromised because you're poor and malnourished, then you are especially susceptible to infections. So all those things are part of the things we have to think about in the way of GM crops. Now then, there are also a very serious aspect of this kind of genetic view of the world, basically, that we live under. And you know, this is the 50th anniversary of the discovery of DNA, and James Watson has been back and forth to Britain in order to celebrate this. And every time he goes, he says further nonsense. You know, he basically says, last time he went there, he basically said, stupidity is the disease. If people are not very clever, if they're ugly, you know, they could actually be made prettier. If they're not, you know, if they're not bright, then they can be actually made brighter, and because it's like a disease, you see, and so on. Now, that is nothing, that kind of nonsense. Of course, Jim Watson was the one who promised to deliver the blueprint for making a human being once the human genome map was mapped, once the human genome was mapped. And of course, that's nonsensical. Basically, that is nothing but the ideology of genetic determinism, which basically says that our genetic makeup determines who and what we are ultimately. And really, this is one of the most persistent myths in the West, in Western science, and it goes back to this whole idea of noble birth and bloodline that must have helped ruling classes retain power within families. So I don't think, you know, genetic determinism did not arise from modern genetics. It is much older than that. But it had a lot of influence in the development of modern genetics. And also this whole notion, because this culture values property so much, that you have to reduce everything to things. You know, that the whole of life, you know, living process, the whole of, you know, life process is reduced to genes. And because genes can then be, you know, possessed and patented and commodified. So now when you reduce everything to genes, you say, well, how can you explain life? Well, you need miracles in order to try and get life out of genes again. But what it is, that this kind of genetic determinism
makes it easy to condone, if not outright justify, slavery and racism. Because just as certain bloodlines are inferior to others, so some races are more primitive or at a lower level of evolution, of a stage of evolution than others. And there are said to be master races that therefore are meant to subjugate and conquer and even eliminate the rest. So these ideas were implicit already before Charles Darwin came along and translated it into science, into biological science. And you know, the full title of his famous book is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. So it is actually quite explicit there. And a key element to Charles Darwin's idea of natural selection was provided, is that my time? By Thomas Malthus. My time is up. It's about Thomas Malthus' theory of population, which stated that human populations tended to increase exponentially, outstripping the means of production, subsistence, and so populations are inevitably kept down by wars, famine, and disease, and the influence of misery and vice. And from this grim and mistaken theory, Malthus concluded that the poor laws of Victorian England, which conferred doles and bounties upon large families, were to be condemned because they would exacerbate the very evils that they were supposed to combat. And so Darwin really was very influenced by that. And now, so as, therefore, it comes as